David Crabtree presented his intellectual autobiography as the seventh talk in a series entitled Coming to Truth on February 13, 2008, at McKinsey Study Center's Wednesday night class. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2008. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
I don't know how long I'm going to go. I'll go till I exhaust you. Charlie said that his was the most unique. Mine is probably the least unique story. But I say face with the thought that it's probably the unique in its non-uniqueness. It is kind of interesting to try to think through how one's intellectual odyssey with respect to Christianity. And that was what I tried to do, and I'm not sure that I captured it. As I think about it, my guess is that most of what has happened in the progress of my thinking about who I am and who God is happens incrementally from day to day, not in big events. So it would be very hard to chart it out. My wife and I go on a walk every morning, and we spend our time talking about our day-to-day lives and what we're thinking about, and it is not uncommon for me to explain to my wife what I've been thinking about this day, and her response is, well, how's that different from the day before? And I say, you weren't listening carefully. So it's incremental changes, barely perceptible changes, but the cumulative impact is significant. So I just went through and picked out some of the bigger events, realizing that probably is not actually a good way of charting it out, but I don't know how else to chart it out. And I've got several ones that I have picked out, and how long we go kind of depends on how carried away I get at telling the stories. I was born into a Christian family, went to church from when I was young, learned to hate it young. I didn't enjoy my church experience. When I got into junior high and high school, it was commonplace in our church for us to go on retreats. They would pile the youth group into a bus, drive them, everybody over to the coast, and spend a weekend there, and then pile them back into the bus and take them to the church. You get out of the bus and walk into the church, into where for the evening service on Sunday, where the choir sat during the morning service, and you'd sit there during the evening service, and then various people would be called upon to give their testimony as to what a wonderful experience the retreat has been. I hated those retreats with a passion. What would happen was, it happened every time, that on the bus ride over, boys and girls would start kind of pairing up. And then by the time we were there, soon after we were there, most of the youth group was paired up, and couples would sneak off and make out whenever possible. And the whole weekend was I found it so depressing that these were the kinds of priorities, and these were the kinds of ways that Christian peers were thinking about things and operating, that it was not fun at all. I didn't like them. And then for everybody to hear everybody's testimonies in front of the church was appalling. As a freshman in college, I went to the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, and wanted to find a group of Christians that I could associate with there. I found out that there was a group of Campus Crusade there. One of my older brothers was on Campus Crusade staff at the time, and so I began to attend their meetings. And they began to take those who were the best Christians out of their group and began to train them so that they could present the gospel. And I was selected to be in that group. And so the first thing we did was develop our testimony. So we would tell how we became a Christian. And we would write that out and we would present it and then they would critique it. And so at certain points, they suggested changes that we would make in it that would make it a little jazzier than it might otherwise have sounded. Then we were trained how to use, how to present the four spiritual laws and how to take the survey. It was called the National Religious Survey. And we were to ask people certain questions and then mark their answers in little bubble circles. And we were to use their answers to those survey questions as the takeoff point then for a way to present the four spiritual laws. And they gave us training on how to do that. So I received all this training and then was given a list of names of people. The goal was to go to every freshman on campus and do the National Religious Survey and present the gospel to them. So I was given a list of names and I started doing my duty. I didn't enjoy it, but I thought that it was something that was good for me to do. So I embarked on this project. After talking to probably a couple dozen people, I found it increasingly difficult to do. But I had this collection of surveys that had been filled out, and we were never told what to do with them. And so I asked the guy who was heading it up if they were collecting those, and he said, "Oh, no, I don't need those." And I said, "Well, aren't you keeping data?" And he says, "Oh, no, not really. We don't need those." And I said, "Well, I thought this was a survey." And he says, "Well, yeah, it's a survey." And I said, "Well, if it seems to me misleading, if you aren't really collecting the data, if you don't care whether we turn these in, this is not really a survey, and this seems kind of contrived and ingenuine to me." And he said, "Well, okay, I'll collect them." And I felt thoroughly pacified. But the whole thing, the more I talked to him and the more training I got, the more I felt like I was being taught how to sell a used car. And it cheapened the whole process. And so it got to the place where he asked me not to attend any longer. And I complied. But my going through my experiences in my youth at church and then these experiences at the University of Pennsylvania really called into question in my mind whether Christianity was true or not. Is it something real, or is it something that we sell? Is it something that we market? Does it have any substance to it? Can it stand on its own? Is it just something that I've borrowed because I'm a Christian, because my parents are Christians? Or is there something true to it? And it was at that time that as I was thinking about that, there are things that came to mind, and there were things that were happening that were very significant in helping me think that through. One was to observe the changes that had taken place in Jack. Jack had gone away to college. Before he had gone to college, his hair was short. He was not a hippie. The hippiest thing about him was that he wore moccasins. But other than that, he was not a hippie. He went away to college and he came back with long hair and beads and various things. But he had been attending a church at Stanford that obviously had made a difference in the way that he was thinking about Christianity. It certainly made a difference in the way that he was thinking about the Bible. And I saw a change in Jack, and in not only in his kind of what superficial religious behavior, but there was a change, I would say, in his actual values. It's I'm sure hard to believe, but Jack inherently has a temper, and I was the object of that on a number of occasions. And he loved to tease and torment me, and I was the object of that on a number of occasions. But there was a significant transformation that took place after he went away to Stanford, and that had a big impact on me. And in talking to Jack and starting to think through these issues, I became interested in doing some reading on my own, and was introduced to C.S. Lewis and Francis Schaeffer, and began reading some of those works. And for the first time, it struck me as at least plausible that Christianity was intellectually defensible. And that was a very exciting thought to me. Another thing that I reflected on quite a bit through this period is also reflecting on the way that my father had related to me. And there was a change in the way that he related to me that was very significant in my life. In my younger years, my dad was very busy working, and my recollection is I didn't have a lot of dealings with him. We didn't have a lot of interaction and didn't spend a lot of time together. But about the time that Jack went away to college, my dad went through a change in the way that he related to me and my younger brother, and started spending more time with us. And earlier, if I were to do something, or probably more likely not do something that I was supposed to do, then my father's response would typically have been to scold me and get upset with me for not having done what I was supposed to do. But there was a palpable change in the way that he started to relate to me and my younger brother about the time that I got into high school. And that was much more patiently responding without really scolding me, but coming alongside and helping me do the thing that I hadn't done. And he would do that time after time after time, where if I wasn't getting something done that needed to be done, or I wasn't doing it right, then he'd come along and help me out. And as I think about it, that's kind of a high-risk approach to take, because it would have been so easy for me to take advantage of that, of his kindness, and just be an enabler. But the actual impact was much different, that it really increased in me a sense of responsibility for doing the things that I needed to do. There was a bit of guilt that was created, but it wasn't guilt that he was imposing. And I could tell that was the case. He was not creating a guilt trip. He was just coming alongside and was consistently very self-sacrificing. And that had a huge impact on me and has continued to have a huge impact on me. I really appreciated the way that he dealt with me, and I have imitated that in a lot of respects as an adult in dealing with others. After I completed college, I went down to Palo Alto and was in the first class of Scribe School, and I suspect that others have talked about Scribe School. But Scribe School was a little unaccredited seminary type training for 2 years that was associated with Peninsula Bible Church, and Jack was one of the teachers in Scribe School. The interesting thing about that experience is I'm sure that I learned some theological tenets there that I still hold, but most of the theology that I remember down there is stuff that I would now take issue with. So it is not what I learned at PBC that was the content of what I learned at PBC that was significant. What I see as significant now is it was the first time that I was in a community of believers where the Bible was really taken seriously, and that people were making a genuine attempt to figure out what the Bible said and then try to live that out in their lives. And in many cases, now I would look back at that and say that there were things that they were doing that were in error, but I still appreciate the fact that the attempt was being made, and it was the first time I'd seen that in a community of believers where the Bible was really taken seriously and Christianity was taken seriously, and that was very inspiring. So all of those things came together and caused me to reflect on Christianity and whether it was something that I believed because it was true or whether it was something that I had just adopted from my parents. And with time, I came to the conclusion that it was something that was true and should be embraced for that reason. There were a couple of crises that I encountered that coincided with this time that were two of the most difficult crises of my life. The first one was a bout with depression. It started when I was a junior in high school. It was the first time that I experienced it. And I know which day it was. It was January 1st of that year. In the evening of January 1st, I just became very fearful. And so fearful that I was shaking. And that began to happen on an almost daily basis, that late in the day I would become very, very depressed. And I ended up going to a doctor, didn't really know what to do about it, ended up prescribing me some sedatives. I took those. I don't think they really did much. I found ways of coping with it. The main way of coping with it, the only thing that I found that really gave me relief was to go out and shoot baskets at our basketball hoop and just play really hard until I got really tired. Getting really tired helped. But then it went away. When the winter was gone, that went away. But the next winter, it came back. The same thing. And it would be almost daily. So it got to the place where I didn't like winters. I expected it to come, and it would come. Some years it was more severe than others. Some years it was quite light. It wasn't much of a problem. But the worst year was my second year of Scribe School, when we were in Palo Alto, and then it got extremely severe. And it was not it was not just in the evenings. It would start, usually it would start after breakfast. Sometimes I'd wake up depressed. And it was a depression, I could feel it happening. I could feel the depression coming on. It was like this cloud just coming down over my head. And I would become fearful, and then I would come up with a reason to be fearful. And it could be anything. It could be a newspaper headline. It could be, if the newspaper headline was somebody murdered somebody, then I was sure I was going to murder somebody. If it was somebody broke into a house and murdered somebody, then I was sure that somebody's going to break into my house and I was going to get murdered. If it was somebody died of drug overdose, then I was going to take drugs. It was whatever my mind latched onto, that was it. The doctors couldn't tell me what's going on. Nobody really knew what it was. The hopelessness was the worst part. The thought that I'm just stuck with this. It was hard to deal with. There were times when I thought that I was going to lose my sanity. That could be one of my fears. I'm going to lose my sanity. But, and there were times when I made a conscious decision, I'm not going to lose my sanity. I want to hang on to this. I want to hang on to reality. And so it was a matter of fighting through it, and I did, and then it eventually cleared up. After that year, after my second year in scribe school, year after year following that, it dissipated a little bit, and within 3 or 4 years after I was married, it was gone, for which I am greatly thankful, because that was quite a burden. The other crisis that I had, I met a girl when I was a senior in college, a girl from Paris. She was a graduate student. She was in several classes that I was taking. I got to know her and became infatuated with her. And at the end of that year, of that senior year, I was off to scribe school in Palo Alto, and she went back to France. And my infatuation with her didn't abate, so I began praying very consistently that God would either help me to forget about her, or that God would make it possible for me to see her again, to reestablish a relationship, and marry her. And I became a prayer warrior for the first time in my life, praying that prayer on a pretty much a daily basis. For it would have been probably 3 years. I went through scribe school, and then I went on a study program to the Soviet Union for about 5 months. When the program concluded, they took us back to. We flew out of the Soviet Union to and went to Paris for our post-program examinations. So we had a whole battery of examinations that we had to take to see how much we had learned when we were in the Soviet Union, how much Russian I had learned. And the place where we stayed in Paris was in the south part of Paris, in a youth hostel. I had this girl's address in my wallet. So after we had been there, we were there for about 5 days. After we had been there for about 2 or 3 days, I decided I'd pull that out and figure out where it was that she lived. And it was one block from our youth hostel. And I had walked by it several times. It was in an apartment complex. And so I thought, well, should I go or should I see if she's there? The chances that she's there are slim. Should I go and see her or not? And I obviously gave in and I went, knocked on their door, and she was the one that answered the door. And she was glad to see me. We talked for a while, and I was in seventh heaven because it looked like God had done everything to bring about an answer to the prayer that I had been praying for so long. Even before I went to her apartment, I had decided that I would like to stay in Paris for a while if I could. And a day or two later, I got a job, which made it possible for me to stay in Paris, which I wasn't sure I would be able to do. So it looked like everything was falling together. And so on probably 2 or 3 occasions then over the next few weeks, I saw her. But it was clear and became even clearer as time went on that she had no interest in me. And she was willing to meet me and be polite, but there really was no significant interest. And so I began this process then of trying to come to terms with what had happened. That I had prayed this prayer for so long, it looked like God was putting things all together as an answer to that prayer and raising my hopes to a level that was unpleasant, and then dashing those hopes. So I spent the rest of my year in Paris doing two things when I wasn't working. Two things. One is a lot of journaling. And I decided I am going to write in my journal what I'm thinking, and I will write only true things. And I was surprised at how difficult it was to write true things. It was amazing to me how often I would start writing in a paragraph and then I'd stop short and say, I'm not being honest with myself here. This needs to be said differently. So I did lots of journaling. And the other thing I did is in the evenings, I would either take off walking or I'd get on the subway and go someplace to some other end of Paris and walk until I got some measure of resolution. That was always my standard of when I could go home, is when I got some measure of resolution. So I got to know Paris very well. I walked all over Paris. If anyone needs a guide and is going to Paris, I'd be glad to do it. And I love Paris. Great place. But the struggle that I went through was essentially, am I willing to follow a God who would raise my expectations so high and dash them? That was the issue. It really had very little to do with the girl. It was this issue of what kind of God is this that I serve? And that was a tough one. And I was angry at God, and it took me a long time to sort it out and think it through and come to resolution. And uh, I I don't know when I became a believer, but if I had to give a time in my life that is the best candidate, it would be when I was in Paris. After that, I came back to the United States and began a process. The way I think about it is a process of growing up and coming to understand what it means to be who I am, what it means to be human in general. And there were two experiences that contributed greatly to that. One was working in Nacelle, staying with my brother and sister-in-law there, working in a youth camp for juvenile delinquents. I learned a lot about human nature there and how people work. It was fascinating to work with those kids and their problems and how to help them in a way that is significant and effective. And my brother and other people that worked at the camp were very helpful in helping me to see that. The other thing was getting married. I met my wife Susan, and fortunately it was not a difficult decision as to whether to marry her or not. That was an easy decision. We got married just 6 months or so after we met. And then it's that I began to learn about myself in a way that I had not previously. For the first time, I was in a situation where I wanted desperately to be a good husband to my wife. And in interacting with her, there were ways in which I was not doing what I needed to do as a husband. And so I was in a situation where I wanted to change and be the kind of person that I needed to be, but came to realize how difficult it is to change oneself. And I have before commented that I was a nice guy until I got married. And what I mean by that is I always thought of myself as a nice guy, but it wasn't until I got married that I realized that the way that I could keep my image of being a nice guy is when I ran into difficulties, you just part ways. And it wasn't until in marriage, where I desperately wanted to stay, to have a healthy relationship, that staying there and working those problems out and working on the changes that needed to be made became really important to me. And I discovered how difficult that is. The next event in my life of major significance had to do with the birth of my fourth child. When my wife became pregnant with the fourth child, they had just instituted a policy of testing all pregnant women, screening them to see if the baby had various kinds of genetic defects. At this time, it was voluntary. I don't know if it's still voluntary. At this time, it was voluntary. And my wife and I talked about it. We were debated whether we wanted to even have the screening done, because we would not have aborted the baby even if it was defective. So we talked to the doctor and said, if we aren't going to abort the baby, is there any reason to do the screening? And he said, yes, because if we know that there are certain kinds of problems, we can start doing some things early that would be good. So we decided to go ahead with the screening. The screening was done, and the test came back negative. There was no indication that there was any kind of genetic defect. The pregnancy, this was my wife's fourth pregnancy, it was her most difficult and the most different of her pregnancies. There were a number of experiences that she had in this fourth pregnancy that were not like her other ones, and she had commented on that a number of times. But about halfway through the pregnancy, I walked into the bedroom, and in the middle of the day, and she was sitting on the end of the bed sobbing. And I asked her what was wrong, and she said, "The baby's got Down syndrome." And I said, "Well, what makes you think that?" She said, "I just know it." And so we talked about it a little bit and said, "Well, we can't really know. We don't. The test showed that there's no genetic problem. We don't really have any reason to think that he has Down syndrome. But even if he does, it wouldn't make any difference. So we'll just proceed and see what happens." So that's the way we settled it, and that's the way we proceeded. The baby was born. Seth was born, and it was late in the evening. And as soon as he was born, and as soon as the doctor left the room, I turned to Susan. I said, "Well, at least he doesn't have Down syndrome." And so we felt good about that. And the fears that she had in the middle of the pregnancy had not turned out to be true. I went home in the wee hours of the morning, received a call at 8 o'clock in the morning, and it was Susan, and she said that she'd just seen the doctor, and the doctor said that Seth had Down syndrome. So that was a shock. That was a difficult thing to come to terms with. We didn't really know anything about Down syndrome. We didn't know what to expect. Social workers and doctors gave us a little bit of information, but the kinds of things that are possible with Down syndrome is a wide spectrum of things, and so it was difficult to get any sense of what we had to work with. And there was one day while Susan was still in the hospital, that she was crying, and one of the things that she was trying to come to terms with is, she said that one of the hardest things for her to think about is that no one would ever say, "You have a cute baby." That was one of the most difficult things she thought that she would have to cope with. So we kind of worked that through as best we could, and took Sethi home from the hospital and tried to go about our job of raising Sethi. We found out soon after that he had a heart defect. And we were told that his chances of survival were about 10%, and that his only chance for survival would be to have an operation, open heart surgery, and as soon as possible. So, and I think he was just 2 or 3 months old when that happened. We went up to Dornbecker Hospital in Portland, they were going to run some tests, and then they were going to operate on him, and they were saying that his chances of surviving would be very, very low. So it was a sad drive up to Portland, and our car overheated on the way, and it was quite an experience. We got to Portland, and they ran the tests, and they came back to us and said, "We aren't going to operate. The situation is not as we thought it was. We thought that he had one problem and that was very severe. He actually has two problems, but they counteract one another, such that they said, we think that he can survive a year very easily, and if we can wait and do the operation when he's 1 year old, that his chances of survival would be much, much better." So we came home and continued to have his situation monitored. And we went back up a year later, and he was operated on. We were at Dornbecker for about a week or so, and it was a period of ups and downs. If you've ever been through that kind of thing, doctors kind of know what's going on, but there's a lot that they don't know. And every time a doctor talks to you, it scares you to death. So our things kind of went up and down, but he came through just fine. Another part of that experience was to see other sick children, children with multiple problems. And by the end of the week, when people would ask us why we were there, we'd say, oh, we just open heart surgery. But one of the interesting things as time went on is Sethi turned out to be a very cute little kid, and he had little glasses, which kind of made him even cuter. And I would have to say that people would come up to us and say, he is so cute, more than for any of our kids. And Sethi has turned out to be a phenomenal contribution to our family. And we have learned a lot from him, and it's been a joy to have him. It has been a trial at a time or two when we couldn't find our keys or wallets or things like that, but it has been a joy. I will race through some of this. I will skip part of this and race through some of this other stuff. As we come to more recent years, I'll just talk about two more things. One is a prolonged and difficult struggle with self-confidence. I would have said when I was younger that I was a very self-confident child, and it wasn't till I started teaching here and had been here for a period of time that I lost my confidence. And coming to terms with that has been very difficult. And trying to sort out whether, as I compare myself, especially as a teacher, with other people, it's been difficult to sort out where I stand, whether I am a good teacher, whether I'm not a good teacher, whether I should be doing what I'm doing, whether I shouldn't be doing what I'm doing. And most of the time that I've taught here, money has been tight. We haven't been paid a lot of money. There were years when we weren't paid very much money at all. And so that just complicated the question and added to the issue of whether this is the thing that I should be doing or not. And that has been an ongoing issue and a difficult one for me to sort out. But over time, it kind of reached the place where I decided, well, this is where I am, this is what I'm doing, and this seems to be where God has placed me, and I will fulfill my role and let God worry about the outcome of that, and let him worry about whether I'm competent to do what he's asked me to do. The other thing that has been significant is the emergence of Gutenberg. Gutenberg is a strange beast. It in many respects should not have come into being. The odds were against us. We didn't know what we were doing. We still don't. And one would think that would make the odds worse of our survival. But we've kind of bumbled along, and there are a number of significant things that have happened along the evolution of Gutenberg that were not planned by us. And when I think about some of the most significant characteristics of Gutenberg, the ways in which it is most powerful, they coincide with the things that we had not planned. And it has given me a huge appreciation for God's ability to work through our incompetence to bring about his purposes. And that has caused me to, when I think about Gutenberg and think about what kind of direction needs to be provided to it, to think in terms of leaving a lot of things up to God. That I'm not interested in micromanaging the development of the college and planning intensively and then following those plans, because I don't know what I'm doing. And I want to be open to letting God steer things. He's shown himself to be faithful. He's shown himself to be more competent than I am at doing that. And that really is a part of the way that I think about Gutenberg and how it develops. I have seen great value in letting things happen, letting things be out of my control and develop as they will develop. And that gets messy at times, but I've really grown in my confidence that in that messiness, God knows what he's doing and he can fulfill his purposes. So I've adopted a policy of acting humbly, recognizing my limitedness and letting things happen. And I've come to see as a part of Gutenberg that everyone's got their own odyssey, that everyone has their own unique odyssey, that all of our students, you see them, their own unique set of strengths and weaknesses, their own unique set of characteristics, and their own unique position in the curriculum, the customized curriculum that God has created for each person. And we get to see a four-year stretch of that curriculum while they're here and play just our little bit in providing that curriculum. But the real director of that curriculum is God, and he's the one who's taking us through our own unique odysseys, and I've come to appreciate that and value that. I think that's phenomenal what God gets accomplished and how he gets those things accomplished. We're over time, but I'm willing to take comments or questions or whatever you have. A mic? Is there a mic?
Did your trip to Russia, wasn't that a highlight anywhere?
It wasn't.
It was sad for me, but... But I just wondered if that...
It was a highlight. It was a lot of fun, first of all. I learned a lot of Russian, secondly. But it was a highlight in that while I was there, I met a man who the story... I was given the name and address of a fellow who lived in Leningrad, and I was asked to take a Bible to him. I knew that it would be difficult to get a Russian Bible in, that could be confiscated. So I said, well, does this guy know English? And I was assured, yes, he does. So I took an English Bible. So when I was there, I went to visit him I introduced myself and gave him the Bible. Didn't speak a word of English. But I began to meet with him several times a week. And we would talk about, he wanted to talk about theology and philosophy. He had become a Christian by reading Dostoevsky. And having become a Christian, he wanted desperately to understand what the Christian perspective is, but didn't have access to a Bible. So the only thing he had access to was he could hear some radio broadcasts from the West, and some of those had Christian teachers. The other thing that he had access to was anti-Christian literature that was put out by the Soviet government. So he would take that and he'd cut out the quotes from the Bible and try to paste those things together to try to figure out what the Bible was saying. So his opportunity to talk to me was every time we met, he had a whole series of new questions that he wanted to talk about. And that was a phenomenal experience. To see a situation in which God was working in those kinds of conditions to affect someone's soul was amazing.
I just want to say I really appreciate your testimony. I was surprised. I think it was my favorite so far, so I really enjoyed it. I just wanted to ask, and this doesn't necessarily have to do with your testimony, but again, I've talked to you a little bit. I really respect your thoughtfulness, like you and Jack both. And as a Christian, I am really into the social justice aspect of Jesus' message. Mm-hmm. And I just would be curious a little bit on any of your thoughts that way, as far as in your process of sort of, struggling with issues and things like that, how you see that part of it in terms of our working as a force of good in the world. Mm-hmm. I know there's always these debates about, what it means to be a believer in, but maybe a little less on that is just how you would personally view the importance mm-hmm. of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, to the extent that I have thought about that, I see the importance of that, and I think we as a community of believers should really take that seriously. But I have become convinced that addressing those kinds of problems needs to be done on the micro level. That is, it's those people around me, it's those needs that I am aware of in my circle of acquaintances. And I think that it is good and proper for people to respond to a leading such that they are brought into contact with needs that they would not otherwise be brought into contact with. But the real needs that need to be addressed are dealing with people as genuine and valued human beings who have souls that God cares about. So it's not programs, it's not the goal is not to get money into the hands of the poor as much as it is extending love and concern to those people that are in situations of need. So I see it on the micro level. It needs to be very personal and very genuine and sincere, but it's something that's very important. It needs to be done.
Thank you. I think that's an excellent answer. I totally agree with the micro and personal, because I really see that sometimes in the institutional programmatic aspect of charity and social yes. justice, yes. it loses that.
Yes.
I think it's that personal relationship which right. makes all the difference in the right. world. So thank
right.
you.
Right. What they need is genuine love and concern. Programs can't do that. In fact, programs get in the way of that. Anything else? Okay, thanks.